Listen, I got a passion for spitting, smashing the competition. Vocals a logo for the back-to-back world champion. Pistons undebatable, flesh is biodegradable. People ego deflatable, see no evil and play the role. I'm Peter Gabriel with a sledgehammer. Blood standards, red-handed, set standards, dedicated, a deal of proof. Abel Miracle, Fannie Lou Hamer, Marlon Riggs, Nina and Fred Hampton. Yeah. There goes the neighborhood like Fred Sanford next door to Ned Flanders. These cats pop off at the mouth like over Redenbacher. My lyrics open up the portal, see your seven chakras. Helicopter circle and watch the exchange of Betty Crocker. Soap operas and Benton drama, prevent it, remember not for smash. Various, various, various on the roadblocks. You don't get it, get it, you do you. The struggle don't stop it, don't quit. Worldwide winning with solid globetrotters. Don't try to sit home if you're stuck in time or broke watches. Smash the walls of hate, end it for the next ascendance. Watching them fall from grace, repping for the independence. Futuristic sound, you just missed it now. Present with the essence, who we ball, but it all is fake, yeah.
You don't pay attention, man.
That's why your power is the size of your attention span. Miller said it best.
You don't pay attention, man.
That's why your respect's the size of your attention span. It's fresh air when I'm speaking to y'all. Sometimes it falls upon deaf ears like I'm speaking to walls. I ain't preaching to y'all, breaking cycles of violence, not repeating they flaws. Open up your memory bank, I got the key to the vault. Serving the antidote to Alzheimer's, deleting and stalk. Can't go below but think it over. We the leaders we've all been waiting for. Believe it, heed the call, breathe it, keeping involved. These lyrics, heat seekers deplete, tweet us till the speakers dissolve. Each generation must find its mission, fulfill or betray it. I know that ours is more than just being killers or players. I'm making millions of papers, our blood is spilling the haters. Too much injustice among us, is it still a complacent? Yeah. Smash the walls of hate, end it for the next ascendance. Watching them fall from grace, repping for the independence. Futuristic sound, you just missed it now. Present with the essence, who we ball, but it all is fake, yeah.
You don't pay attention, man.
That's why your power is the size of your attention span. Miller said it best.
You don't pay attention, man.
That's why your respect's the size of your attention span. Smash the walls of hate, end it for the next ascendance. Watching them fall from grace, repping for the independence. Futuristic sound, you just missed it now. Present with the essence, who we ball, but it all is fake, yeah.
You don't pay attention, man.
That's why your power is the size of your attention span. Miller said it best.
You don't pay attention, man.
That's why your respect's the size of your attention span.
Wanting people to listen, you can't just tap them on the shoulder anymore. You have to hit them with a sledgehammer. And then you'll notice you've got their strict attention.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the basement of Carruthers Hall, Queen's University campus, Kingston, Ontario, Turtle Island, and you're listening to Bash Back. Welcome to today's show.
This is DJ Flip.
I'm DJ Revolva.
And I'm DJ Frass. We're going to start off today's show with a few community announcements.
So this Friday, March 4th, from 6 to 9 p.m., is the launch of Downpour, an anti-prison publication, at the Artel, 205 Sydenham Street, and it's co-presented by EPIC and the Prison Industrial Complex. So come out for honking good time with fellow townies who aren't about to tip their hats to the prison aristocrats. Snacks, coffee, and other drinks provided.
And on Wednesday, February 16th at 12 p.m. Till March 17th at 6 p.m., folks are looking for some queer and trans pen pals. It's hosted by the Prisoner Correspondence Project and Smash Fortier. And the prison, the Prisoner Correspondence Project is seeking queer and trans people interested in becoming pen pals. Their current waiting list for folks on the inside is 3 to 6 months, and when it was once about 6 weeks. If you are interested, please check it out at prisonercorrespondenceproject.com/get-involved and then get in touch with them.
And tell several friends.
Yay!
And also, there has been a call for submissions put out for a zine dealing with body, hair, size, fat phobia for and by Indigenous peoples and people of color. So the new deadline is March 31st, 2011. So basically, this is a zine for self-identified Indigenous peoples and people of color, mixed race people, who have something to say about fat, size, hair, body image, shit, and anything else that affects body, self-love, and ability to love others. So they're looking for art, writing, prose, poetry, essays, collages, lyrics, photos, yeah, all kinds of stuff. You can send submissions to thisisourzine, all one word, at gmail.com, with submission as the subject.
Right, and Toronto is holding their Israeli Apartheid Week starting March 7th. At the University of Toronto Fitzgerald building, with a panel called Interrogating Apartheid Campus as a Site of Resistance, with speakers Judy Rebick, Abby Bakken, and members of Students Against Israeli Apartheid. So there's a whole stream of events for the week. And a really interesting one is happening on Wednesday, March 9th. At Bann Auditorium at University of Toronto at 7 p.m., which is on cultural and academic boycott, with Judith Butler as the speaker. So if you want to check out some of those events, it is at toronto.apartheidweek.org.
And I think that's it for today's community announcements. Well, something that we just found out, though, is that the Queen's Pride Project schedule has been released. I don't know, was that today?
Yeah, or today.
Today, mm-hmm. So very new. You should check out their Facebook page for the full schedule of events. There are a few really cool ones.
Yeah, and we'll be letting you guys know as they come up what's going on for that. Yeah, there are a lot of really exciting things happening for that week, which I believe is on the third week of March.
And if you have a hard time tracking them down online, I'd suggest going to outinkingston.org, which has also hosted the entire schedule of events and has links to their website on it.
So now, a little bit of a news update for you guys.
Bear with us, some technical difficulties.
So essentially, this sort of fits in with our last community announcement about Israeli Apartheid Week, which is coming up very soon across North America, cities across North America. So what happened was the New York Gay and Lesbian Community Center essentially canceled an event that was a dance party to raise awareness about Israeli apartheid and the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And so this is sort of a really crazy case of pinkwashing in action. Director Michael Lucas is a really famous queer porn director, gay porn director, I mean, sorry. And he has been really active in his support of Israel and Zionism and has made a number of comments vilifying the Middle East for being homophobic and glorifying Israel as being the only safe haven for queers in the Middle East, which is entirely false in a number of ways and is extremely Islamophobic and Orientalist and buys into all kinds of really effed up narratives. And he essentially put pressure on the center, threatening that a number of prominent donors would rescind their funding and support for the center if this event were to happen, and so it was canceled. So this is an example of how Israeli propaganda has been invading queer spaces and attempting to silence any discussion of Israeli apartheid and any solidarity movement between queers here and Palestinians and Palestinian queer folks.
And Mike Lucas is actually a columnist for The Advocate, which is a gay and lesbian magazine, and which is extremely, extremely influential. So his voice is really has really influenced the center. That was nothing. Ignore that. The response has been there has been a big response with asking the center to sort of rescind that decision, and there's been an online petition and asking it to return to its mission as a space for the oppressed and marginalized, instead of becoming, and I quote, another occupied, homogenized venue where wealthy and powerful voices can squelch the rest. And both Judith Butler and Lisa Duggan have also weighed in and has asked the center to remain open for all of its communities. So far there hasn't been, I don't believe there has been any decision made on that to sort of rescind.
Right, and that's all we have for today's news segment. We have some very exciting programming coming up on today's show. DJ Flip and I had the pleasure of interviewing Daniel Heath Justice a couple of weeks ago. And we're going to have that interview on the show today.
But right now, I think we're going to go through a little bit of music first. So stay tuned.
From the trees that had been fruiting, and in the kingdom there was not a girl that was so fly. Maps and writings of a new world, and in the kingdom there was not a girl that was so wise.
Yeah. I miss her in the scornful winds of winter. I miss her when the sun falls from the sky. But when I see the lively green of springtime, I dream that someday Friday will be mine.
So we just figured we'd give you a bit of an introduction to the interview before it went on. So just to give everyone a sense of context, Daniel Heath Justice is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, a permanent resident of Canada, and associate professor of Aboriginal literatures in the Department of English and affiliate faculty member of the Aboriginal Studies program at the University of Toronto. He's also the author of Way of Thorn and Thunder, an indigenous epic fantasy written as a trilogy. The first book, Kinship, tells of Everland, home of the forest-dwelling kin and the other eld folk since time immemorial, a deep green world of ancient mystery and sacred shadow. The weir powers of the kin and other eld folk have been preserved in this lush region from the ravenous imperialism of humanity for over 1,000 years, but those powers are now under siege, and the assimilationist kin's shields seek to purge the people of the weir, seeing only savagery in its mysteries and in its guardians, the wielders. And as the power of the shields grows, and the hungry eyes of men turn once more to the Everland and its rich bounty, the leaders of the seven nations of folk gather in Shainadwin. I may be saying that wrong, I apologize. The King Capital to seek a way of surviving the growing storm. These stories center ingenuity and queer two-spirit identities, and recenter science fiction and fantasy from the perspective of the colonizer to the perspective of those resisting colonization.
So this is DJ Fraz and our interview with Daniel Heath Justice. So enjoy. So we're here at Hotel Belvedere in front of a nice fire with Daniel Heath Justice. Say hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you started writing fiction, particularly science fiction and fantasy?
Sure. I grew up in a little mining town in Colorado. My family was one of the only Native families there, although I didn't really pay much attention to that because, you know, everybody was pretty much working class and poor. It didn't matter kind of what our other backgrounds were. Small little town of about 250 when I was there. It's grown significantly. It's now 400. Went to the same class, kindergarten through graduation, graduating class of 23, and off to university, and then, you know, kind of over time, kind of doing a lot of work with cultural recovery and not being ashamed of where I came from. And part of my going into fantasy literature was, when I was a kid, fantasy was a place where anything was possible and I could imagine otherwise, and it was a place where the dorky little nerds had power. Right? You might be bookish, but those books were magic books and you had spells and you could take care of your persecutors. But it was also a place I really struggled against a lot of kind of self-hate, class self-hate, and racial self-hate. And so when I was a kid, I became a huge Anglophone. Or Anglophile. I really wanted to just move to England and be a Rhodes Scholar and wear tweed and drink tea and smoke a pipe in oak panel drawing rooms and talk about big ideas with other civilized people. I didn't want to be this little mixed-blood hillbilly with ambiguous sexuality and gender inclinations. And it wasn't until I was in university that I really started to come out of that. And part of that was through fantasy. That fantasy novels gave me a sense of other opportunities, but as I got older, most fantasy novels that I was reading were very much within a European tradition. And a tradition very much of kind of the supremacy of a European civilization over swarthy tribal peoples. And I don't remember when it was, but it suddenly occurred to me that my family were those tribal peoples who were being slaughtered or who were fading before the inevitable ascent of men. And so I started wanting to write the stories I wanted to read because there just weren't enough of them out there. There were some work by Ursula Le Guin and Octavia Butler, C.J. Cherry and other writers, almost all women, many of whom, women of color, but fantasists of color, kind of radical fantasists, really, they had good work, but there just wasn't enough of it. And there were very, very few that kind of dealt with indigenous issues in a really significant way. And so that's what I wanted to write. I was going to be a scholar, that was something, but scholarship is one thing I do and I love it, but fantasy is another love that maybe is little, that drives me in significant ways as well.
So the trilogy that you've written, The Way of Thorn and Thunder, mm-hmm. So what was sort of your goals in writing that trilogy? You've talked a little bit about what fantasy sort of like meant for you, but like what was, I guess, sort of like the driving force behind like wanting to write that, or like writing that trilogy?
First, I just wanted to tell a fun story that interested me. And almost inevitably, it was going to be one that dealt with indigeneity, with sexuality, with gender. Most of the major characters are women. All of them are strong. There are a lot of queer and genderqueer characters in the books. I wanted a story that would have a lot of diversity. There are disabled characters in the books, characters of a lot of different physical types. I wanted something that reflected the diversity of the people who are in my life and the values that are significant to me. But it was first the story, and I didn't want the politics to dominate the story. I wanted them to give life to the story. Because I think if you put the politics first, the story dies, the characters seem flat. But if the politics are part of the story, it's a different matter entirely. Originally, it was kind of an allegory of the Cherokee Trail of Tears. But very quickly, it became something different. Because once you start telling that story, it has its own life and it has its own direction. And so it's a removal story. It's a story about indigenous people struggling to maintain their homeland and their cultural integrity under assault. But it's not the Trail of Tears. It's the Darkening Road. It's the tale of these indigenous peoples and their particular struggles. And I'm pretty happy with the result. I have sequels in mind. It's not the book I'm working on now, but it's a world that I love and would love to inhabit more. But this particular cycle, I'm really happy. It's kind of come together, and the characters really... I love them. They're some of my favorite.
So a lot of your work, especially in The Way of Thorn and Thunder, tackles themes of identity, and you've said indigeneity, nationhood, authenticity, and decolonization. So can you tell us a little bit about how your work has been received and engaged with by other Native literary scholars and critics, as well as non-Native scholars and critics?
My scholarship is... kind of what I'm known for in my field. I have a more of a scholarly profile than as a novelist. I know a lot of people have taught the books, and I've heard really good things about that experience. in some ways, fantasy is an easier way for students to kind of engage these issues than kind of straight history. I think it's not as threatening, but sometimes it's a little bit more subversive. It still gets to them. So that's most of the response I've gotten has been through teaching. Not so much scholarship. There are a few people, I've been to a couple of conferences where people were talking about the books, and that's fun. I've enjoyed that. There was some, it was really good interaction, really good interpretations, and things that really surprised me that people were finding in them. But there hasn't been a lot of scholarship on them. I think part of that is there's just a lot of work. And I think part of it, too, is people don't really know what to do with fantasy. That's kind of still, it's still the, I wouldn't say it's disrespected, but it's just weird. People don't really know what to do with fantasy. And then kind of indigenous fantasy is indigenous, but it's still kind of weird. So I get that. I would love to see some fun criticism about it. I've gotten some student papers, graduate students or undergrads who've written on it and have sent their papers to me. And that's been so rewarding and so much fun. And just to see how people interpret it differently than I do, but in good ways. So we'll see. The books are coming out as a single volume in April from the University of New Mexico Press, and so distribution will be a lot easier. So I imagine there'll be more possibility for that now that it's all together in a single volume and readily available. Who knows? I'm hopeful. Maybe when the movie comes out, right?
So what kind of feedback have you had sort of outside of like the realm of like scholarship, I guess, and like students or other literary critics like giving feedback? What other type of response has it?
I've had really good responses. My very favorite response. So every once in a while I'll get an email out of nowhere. And I got a really sweet email from a woman, I don't know anything about her. All it said was, I really loved your books. Thanks for thinking of us chunky chicks. And I thought, that's the sweetest response ever. Because my characters are not, now you wouldn't know it from the covers of the trilogy, mm-hmm. but in the book, these are women with shape. These are voluptuous figures, and I wanted a variety of body types in here. And so that was just the loveliest email. That's the kind of response I love. But I've gotten a lot of nice emails from folks when I've gone to classes to talk, really fun conversations with students, and then just friends and family who've read them and had really nice conversations, people who just, I really want to talk to you about this. And one thing I sometimes do when I'm talking with classes that I've read, I talk to people, okay, who's your favorite character? And everybody has a different favorite character and different reasons for it. And we have really nice conversations. Not much critical response. We did get some lovely blurbs for the Omnibus edition. We got a blurb from Ursula Le Guin, which just kind of thrills me to no end. And some other just splendid blurbs from fantasy writers. And that, as well as Aboriginal writers. And all the way along, we've had some really nice blurbs from Richard Van Camp and Michelle St. John and Drew Hayden Taylor and other folks. And that's been incredibly rewarding. But it's also nice to have fantasists recognize this. Of course, all of the fantasists are women. Karen Lawachi is a fantasist and science fiction writer of color in Toronto who has written some just brilliant, brilliant work. And it's very rewarding to have, especially because most of the characters are women, and these are women of color in this world. It's very rewarding that it's women and women of color and queer folks who are seeing themselves reflected in a way that they find heartening. You could do it badly and just piss people off, and I don't think that's been the case, and that I think has been the most satisfying thing.
Do you find that including queer identities as primary characters is easier to do in the genre of fantasy?
Fantasy is pretty conservative in a lot of ways. There are some people who do have queer content, but it's still a pretty heteronormative field. Science fiction may be a little less so, but I think fantasy, it's hard to find queer characters in fantasy. And often when you do, they're really minor characters. And so I don't find it hard to write it. I didn't find it hard to kind of have it in my world, because that just how I couldn't not. But when I'm reading other work, that's where it's difficult. Again, the writers I've been talking about are people who do it, but it's still a minority. And folks have been pleased. My mom was a little uncomfortable with the one queer sex scene, the polyamorous sex. That was the only one that she's like, I don't mind them being queer, but it's awfully, I don't know. I said, well, Mom, that's got to stay in. I am not polyamorous. You don't have to worry about that. But these characters are. This is significant to these characters. So, and I get that. She's my mom. I'm her baby. And my mom actually followed these characters, because I first started writing about these characters when I was 12. So she's seen them through all their manifestations. And I think it was an interesting moment for her when she kind of had to deal with these characters coming out, right? As I grew up, of course they're going to start. Like, oh, of course, okay. It's good, it's fun, but there are also straight characters, straight-identified characters in there as well. And I give them a sex scene, too. I don't imagine that it's quite as hot as the queer one, but you have to speak to straight folks, I guess.
So the talk you're giving in Kingston is called Four Questions, Critical Kinship in Theory and Practice, I think is the name. Maybe can you give us a bit of an idea of some of the things that you're going to talk about, or like an idea of what the talk is about for people who can't attend?
Well, it's different than it was going to be, because I've been speaking with so many wonderful people on my visit here, and I'm changing the talk, kind of extemporaneously, so I'm a little bit nervous. It'll still be rooted in this issue. Four questions that have been really guiding a lot of my practice lately about how we understand one another as kin. And we often talk about all my relations, or we are all related, but sometimes those are just words. And it's hard for people to kind of... I think... living that, or being guided by that in a really significant way, is what I'm curious about. That's what I want to kind of ask myself and other people. How do we live these values? And not just with other human beings, but with the other than human world. How do we make our interactions with one another good, and treat one another as relatives in a really responsible way? So those are the four questions. And then I want to kind of apply those questions, or some of those questions, to some of the issues that are going on here in Kingston, and some of the issues that are going on at Queens that I've been talking with people about. I think one thing I really want to do is give honor to the important work that's being done here from a lot of people. And hopefully, and if my words can kind of help give recognition or strength to that, I'm very delighted to do it. But we'll see. After the talk, let's see how it went. But that's kind of the focus is, how can we learn to take care of each other in really expansive ways? Kind of radical inclusion at its best. And what does that mean? What does that call upon us to do? So we shall see.
So some of your work has been sort of in terms of the movement, amongst a number of critical Indigenous scholars towards an Indigenous literary nationalism. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, for me, literary nationalism is at its core about responsible specificity, kind of looking at the specifics of a community's experiences and working in your kind of discussion about the work or the community or anything, working from that ground, not assuming that there's this kind of all-encompassing perspective, but really getting down to the specifics. What's going on the ground? What is the specific history of this community, or the specific history of this particular writer? What are the specific issues that are of concern, and how are those revealed through the text? And how do the specific traditions, aesthetic, intellectual, spiritual, political, how do the traditions of that specific community inform and shape the literary expression coming out of that community? That, to me, kind of in a nutshell, is what literary nationalism is. It's not about, it's only us and nobody else. It's not about this kind of exclusivist model. It's about, you know, going to home ground and then extending out, but starting first in the local and then moving and taking into account all of the other influences that are there, but not assuming that those influences somehow diminish or erase what's going on at the heart. But they're mutually constitutive. So that, to me, is what literary nationalism is about.
Is there anything else you want to say to our listeners?
Really, I've had such a wonderful visit, and I'm very, very grateful to the kind of generous reception I've had here. People have always been wonderful when I've been here, but this visit, I've been able to stay a little bit longer, and just the good hearts and good minds and strong spirits of people who are doing important work and challenging difficult issues. I'm so, so honored to be able to be within your sphere of influence a little bit. So just thank you. And thank you for this opportunity as well.
Do you have a music request?
Ooh. Do you have any Dolly Parton?
We can find some Dolly Parton.
All right, if you've got some Dolly Parton, if you can find Light of a Clear Blue Morning.
Okay.
That's a good Dolly song. All right.
Thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you. I really appreciate it. This is great.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
For the sun. She's so mad. 16 car star, you so far from rock. You want tour in a foreign car? That's cool, I'm aiming for a better life. Spit hot fire, feel my Beretta light. Damn, she's so, so, no, no, better like. I'm all pro, yo, portable, better like. Whether in hobo or polo, I am fresh. Spotlight here and I am next. Train out these niggas with iron net. Lost some, gained some, well, I am next. Cause I might lose some, but you just gained one. Might lose some, but you just gained one. Might lose some, but you just gained one. Just gained one. Just gained one. You might lose some, but you just gained one. Might lose some, but you just gained one. Might lose some, but you just gained one. You on every station. Sure. Truth gets you a new replacement. But I'm here to rock the nation. No J. No J. Some cups of rosé. It's raw on the rocks. Take shots, no chase. Bras on the watch. Try to clock my pace. I'm G-Shock. You re-bop to my taste. Come on. What a waste of talent. Use my styling to create balance. Feel like a nomad on this island. Cause I be wildin' when I be rhyming. You one of a kind. You can pick any one of my lines. Compare them to the greatest of all time. And all my competitors, yes, hey, you so far. So ahead of my time, I lost my mind. I regather them ghosts that I lost just fine. I am back to the future, and who are you serving? For the crow with a rooster, MC's morning, and I'm just yawning. I'm about to bed, I ain't have to turn nothing on, cause it's never dormant, and I'm on it. Yeah, I swear I said it right, send it to the internet, upload megabytes. All they do is megabyte, that's right, said it twice. Sick up in the head like I think I need a medic right now. Tell them haters pipe down, cause they probably smoke a crack, they ain't feeling my style. Take next, I'ma get it right now. Be the only skinny rapper with a million pounds. Like you might lose some, but you just gained one. You might lose some, but you just gained one. You might lose some, but you just gained one. Just gained one. Just gained one. You might lose some, but you just gained one. You might lose some, but you just gained one. You might lose some, but you just gained one. Just gained one.
Count to three. Make a wish. Make a wish.
You may come right in.
Make a wish. Make a wish. Count to three. Hold your breath. Hold your breath. Count to three. Make a wish. Make a wish. Count to three. Make a wish. Count to three. Make a wish. Make a wish.
Yeah, imagination. Nation.
Excuse me.
Oh no, no. Rap diddy. Rap diddy.
Yeah, imagination, nation,
and you.
Imagination, nation.
Your imagination.
Imagination.
Every day lost in imaginings. Going with the flow like paddling. Was never ever part of my little mighty scheme. Had a dream to be like dude off the gravel team, Rockefeller. Now I rock it like gasoline. Matches for it like slashes. Dreams happening. Fat kid fascinating. Ramadan, how I hunger for the crackling. Pop sound, see me traveling. Champ ship since I was a small kid. Doing somersault flips. I was battling an imaginary player with a sword and a tongue slayer. Pirating. Lost in imagining. Imaginings. Now I wanna live like a lavish queen. Lavish queen. Childhood dreams. Now this real life flow is what I'm mastering.
Yeah, imagination. Nation.
And you'll
imagination, imagine.
Never played doll tea partying, but I would serve a couple words, flow startling. Harboring skill, modeling the lottery. Picks, New Jersey from the bricks, still following. The night's mini mics on my mind, taking flights on a kite. Damn, ain't life icing with the sweet dreams that I'm eiffling on, leaning on, but I slept. Every dawn ciphering, woke tightening, strike pins lightening, writing, imagining that I flow like water for the Vikings. Lost in imagining names in my eyes of the side grass, never green, green. See a whole nother color, see a whole nother color scheme. So with that imagining, I can be anything, anything. Shooting for the stars, hit a pistol ring. Stuck in imaginings, yeah, still I dream.
You want a new paradise? Simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world? There's nothing to do.
No.
Yeah, imagination. And you. Imagination.
Your imagination.
Yeah, imagination. And you're in a
world of your imagination.
I'm with you.
There it goes.
And
welcome back. We're just going to run over some of the music that we've played so far. The first song earlier was Friday by Be Steady.
Then after the interview with Daniel Heath Justice, we heard from Dolly Parton with Light of a Clear Blue Morning.
Following that, we have RA the MC featuring Prover with Lost Ones.
And that last track was Rhapsody with Imagination.
Alright, so if you guys weren't enticed enough with the interview, we're gonna read a little bit of Daniel Heath Justice's work from the book, the first book in the trilogy called Kinship. Just gonna read, give you a little snippet to, and you can borrow, if you're around Queens, you can borrow the books. They're on reserve at Stauffer, and they're also at Four Directions Aboriginal Student Center.
Where's stones for skin? Stalked with an easy grace through the canyon toward Red Cedar Town. He was the steady walk of one to whom fear was barely the itch of a memory. He was in no hurry. Time was his own. Only the rumbling in his stomach, like two river rocks grinding against each other, gave any indication of his purpose. For he hungered this day as he always hungered. He knew that he would feed well at his destination, even if the kin fled at his approach. He would sniff out all their hiding places, from the forest canopy to the root-tangled caves. His untiring pace was more dependable than their panic. They would run, they would tire, and then they would die. He stopped and looked with some satisfaction at the stinking elk skin he pulled along behind him, piled high with rotting kin bodies in a fly-swarmed mass. He bent and tore a large bite from a leg severed roughly at the hip, the bone gleaming in the leaf-shadowed sunlight. A thick stream of blood and saliva slid down his cobbled chin, but he ignored it. His thoughts wandered elsewhere. Old meat was tasty, but it was empty of spirit. He much preferred his food warm and screaming. Three towns were behind him, Nine Oaks, Downbriar, and High Marching, and perhaps 24 more lay ahead in the deep clefts and wooded valleys of this end of the Craggan Mountains, where stones for skin had fed well in the weeks since he fled his own rocky ridge up north. While kin were not his favorite meat, he particularly enjoyed the rare and savory deep rock gvergs, as their struggles were more desperate and delicious. He could hardly remember a time when he was so well fed. Of course, the kin had fought back valiantly with all manner of weapons, stone and copper blades, stout wood and bright fire, even pitfalls and more ingenious traps. But he was a feaster, one of the eaters of old, and his thick gray skin was dense with thousands of jagged stones that protected him from most wounds. Those wisdom keepers who had once challenged him and his kind were rare these days, driven from these lowlands by their own people, and their teachings now lay hidden in dark, secret places, leaving his ravenous path clear. His chewing slowed slightly. No, it wasn't just those wise ones of the elder times who could have driven him away. Now there were others, bright-eyed, hairy creatures with sharp iron and a hunger almost as great as his own, and it was their unyielding persistence that had sent him fleeing from his beloved high mountain cave to these ancient wooded valleys in the Southlands. Those pain-bringers made him an exile, and he hated them even more than he hated the blazing light of the sister suns, now mercifully shrouded by the thickly crowded pines lining the canyon. He pulled a resistant tendon from his teeth and tossed it into the ferny undergrowth, and his pebbled brows narrowed in memory of his desperate escape. There were some who could hurt him. Their cruel, shining weapons burned through stony flesh, and the wounds festered and ached for days. But there was no smell of humans in these valleys. Those creatures were far away, and he was safe. Nothing worried him here.
Where stones for skin grunted and moved forward again, carelessly dragging the skin behind. His path led up a slope along a dry riverbed that cut a deep gorge through the mountain. The pathway was littered with river stones and larger rocks, but there was a manageable trail to follow. As he shifted his massive frame between the two smooth boulders, he lifted his nose to smell the air. A broad grin split the knobbly gray head. His fat lip parted to reveal dozens of broken brown teeth, and he inhaled again, deeper this time. Hekin waited for him on the walls of the canyon above. Where Stone for Skin slowly swung his head back and forth, catching the different scents, each lingering for a moment on his tongue as he counted the distinctive odors of 11 warriors with freshly uprooted stones ready to toss down. He tasted the soil's sharp tang in the air, mingled with the softer sweetness of fear. His smile grew larger. The feeding was always better when he could play a bit. Pretending to be unaware of their presence, Where Stone for Skin moved forward again, his heart beating faster in anticipation. The canyon narrowed. Despite his massive bulk of 20 feet high and at least half that wide, he passed smoothly through the gap, walking with the ease of a two-legged panther, the slow certainty of a patient hunter. The smells of the Hekin were stronger now, and Where Stone for Skin could barely conceal the deep chuckle that rattled in his belly as he continued up to the slope to a level path ahead. The feaster sniffed in the air for a moment and nodded with satisfaction. The Hekin were at the upper ridge of the gorge, only about 50 strides ahead. He would let them throw down their rocks for a while. He might even pretend to be crippled by their attack. He liked games, and this one was one of his favorites. When these proud warriors were sure of their success and curious about their wounded quarry, he would stop playing again and begin to feast.
As he rounded another large boulder in the path, Where Stone's fresh skin stopped suddenly. His watery yellow eyes narrowed. Not far ahead, a lone Shekin stood in the path to block his way. She was small but solid, not much taller than 5 feet, but there were powerful muscles under the green flesh, and she promised to fight with far more enthusiasm than was demonstrated by the spindly oldsters and squalling fat babies of the former towns. Her pupilless turquoise eyes were hard with cold anger. As odd as it was for him to see the red thorn she-warrior among the fighters, Where Stones for Skin was more intrigued than worried. Though the red thorns were skilled opponents, they were rare. The feaster had seen none of their kind in the earlier towns he'd raided, and very few in the ages before that. They, like the wisdom-bearing wielders, belonged more to memory than to the living age. Like most kin, this red thorn was solid, her body's curves round and full, her arms and legs tightly muscled, but not bulky. She held only one weapon in her three-fingered hands, a long black bladed spear. It was an inconsequential defense. Okay, I think we'll stop there. So that's, once again, is from the first book, Kinship, by Daniel Heath Justice. And yeah, I think we're good.
That's all we have time for on today's show. We're going to leave you with a few promos, and we'll see you / talk to you next week.
All right, this is DJ Flip.
I'm DJ Revolva.
And I'm DJ Fries. Take care.
Have a good night.